News time now, 8:20. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour on KPCW. Well, as voters consider the request from Park City School District to approve a $56 million bond, they should know that $12 million of that is being reserved for athletic facilities. In the studio with details about what's being proposed, I have Park City Business Administrator Todd Halber, and on the phone with me, Park City High School Athletic Director Jamie Sheets. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
So can we talk about just the breakdown of the $12 million? The notes on the website, pretty vague. I mean, we're talking about grouping fields, tennis courts, but either of you?
Sure. So the $12 million has several concepts built into it. One of it has to do with the relocation of Dozier Field. Should the design teams go that route at the end of the day, there's money set aside, and that's around $5 million to both move the field and the track up into the North 40. And with that, then the remaining balance of the $12 million is available for looking at the field house itself.
So when do we make that decision?
So the design teams will be beginning here shortly, and they should get their work done in January timeframe. And so between now and January, we should have a pretty good idea of what it is we're looking at building.
So we know 56 would be the max. Not all of the bonds have to be sold, though, if you, in fact, decide not to move the field?
Correct. So we'll be working with the design teams and then also with the contractor and the construction manager to put the scheduling together so that we'll know which projects need to come online first, second, third, et cetera. And then we'll have a good idea of timing of the bond needs.
All right. Well, Jamie, you're a big supporter of moving the field. How come?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I'm a supporter of whatever's best for our kids and whatever's going to work out best. If the design team says they're going west with the expansion on the high school, then obviously it's that domino falls and we have to move the field at that point. If it stays because we go a different route with the high school expansion, I'm fine with that too. But there's other things then we've identified then would need to be done at its current location.
Okay, well, let's talk just a little bit about that. Let's just say that it does get moved. It's going to be moved where? Do we have a location for it?
We're looking at just right now. You're looking at the Treasure Mountain footprint, essentially, or property right there. Right now, probably east of where Treasure Mountain is, there's those fields. However, that hasn't been 100% determined exactly what that footprint would look like for a field over there on the east side of campus.
All right. And then what about, so that would be the field. What about the track? Because there has been some talk about separating the two.
There has been talk of moving the track off of the field, just from a use standpoint, the way the things don't necessarily agree with each other during the day when we're using them. So we have looked at the North 40 as a possibility for having a track facility. But it's still in play as possibly putting it on the south side of that part, which would be down by Treasure. But, yeah, we have looked at the North 40.
All right. So a new Dozier Field is built. Would we still call it Dozier Field?
I don't see why we couldn't. Dozier Field was named simply because of the amount of work that people were putting into the current location. But I don't see why we couldn't call it a new Dozier Field.
All right. Well, of course, it stands for Jack Dozier, a former mm-hmm. principal there at the high school that was very instrumental in getting that built. So would a new field have turf or grass?
I think it wouldn't be prudent in Park City to put grass in on a competition field, so I would definitely push for turf.
All right. And then as part of that, you would need new concession stands, the press box, storage.
And the facilities that we're looking at are more for taking care of our own student-athletes, as well as what you mentioned, as well as concession stand, as well as press box. We are very tight up there. We get requests for media to get up there, as well as visiting coaches, our coaches, everybody who's actually game management working. We're pretty tight. But we don't have any locker rooms out at Dozier. We don't have any officials space out at Dozier. So it would be nice to be able to have those things on a multi-use facility, a facility that gets used by more than one of our teams.
Yeah. So today, how often is Dozier Field actually used?
Just about every day. If football is not on it, we have Lacrosse, both boys and lacrosse, a practice on it. Soccer team, our boys soccer team is dedicated at Dozier right now during the spring. The spring, it gets really bad, especially, which I should call it late winter, technically. Sometimes we'll have six teams stacked on it for practices, and it'll go to about 9:30 at night. So it makes it pretty difficult between baseball, softball, boys soccer, tracks out there. You got both lacrosse teams. So tonight, for example, girls soccer will play their senior night over at Dozier as well.
Yeah. So it sounds like it's mostly used, besides football games and championship games, it sounds like it's mostly used as a practice field, and that's because of the turf?
Correct. The turf is, there's a lot of advantages to having a turf surface in this climate, especially when the snow comes down, is being able to get on it. And that's why there is such a demand for it, is with as few turf surfaces as we have in Park City, there's high demand for those. So obviously we try to take our high school kids and push them towards Dozier, since that's what it's for. So going into a new facility, obviously it would be nice to be able to make some accommodations, knowing the use we have for it, to be able with either the locker rooms or just the facilities in general, like storage.
Yeah. So the girls, I mean, I've watched lots of soccer games, and really it's only been a championship game. And as you mentioned, you know, the senior game tonight, but most of those soccer games are played out on the North 40 fields, and most of the lacrosse games are played out at Quinn's Junction. So,
well, I would debate the lacrosse thing, the lacrosse games. In my opinion, most of them are played out here, at least from the girls' side. I know the boys will play out at Quinn's. The boys try to get on over here as much as possible. And that's one of the reasons that if I would be in support of the field being over where Treasure Mountain is now, is to accommodate soccer being able to play in the stadium. Right now, with the large distance between Dozier Field and where girls soccer normally plays their games, they generally won't come over to the stadium to play. And we also have to find a place for football. If you would have a stadium over at the Treasure Mountain facility, it would be a short hike for either team to go back and forth between the Treasure Field or stadium and any practice area up on the North 40. So the girls could play all of their games in the stadium.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about lacrosse, because, I mean, there's certainly, I mean, it's like the fastest growing sport, I think, in Park City. But at this point, it's still a club sport. So, I mean, is the school district responsible for making sure that they have facilities?
Lacrosse, mountain biking, hockey, and water polo are all competitive club sports under Policy 9046 with the school district. So they do get benefits. They do get facility use. They are not essentially sanctioned or school supported. So there is that. Lacrosse isn't a sanctioned sport in Utah yet. So it's growing. A lot of schools are adding teams, so you may see that in the future. But they get access to facilities just like the rest of our teams do.
Yeah. Now, how come, like, the 150 kids, though, at Park City Ski Team don't get access to any of the facilities?
Well, we don't have a ski mountain with the high school for them. They can come in and use the weight room facility or training if they needed to, but they're not a school club. Lacrosse, mountain bike, hockey, water polo, they are recognized school clubs under Policy 9046.
So I've never
seen anything from ski team come through.
Oh, so they would have to apply then to the district to become a club sport?
Yeah, there's a little bit of paperwork that they need to do.
A little bit, yeah. Well, let's talk just a little bit about, I mean, there seems to be some confusion about how the new athletic facilities. Oh, well, let's talk a little bit about that. So the field gets moved, and then where do the locker rooms go? I mean, do they stay at the gymnasium, or do they get moved to the Dozier Field area?
No, the locker rooms would go over with the facility, simply because if a field house would go in next to it, if it did, even if it didn't, you still have that, we'll call it an athletic complex, I guess, that would almost be a hub. So at that point, you've got a little bit more of a central location that most of the teams are working out of. So that's where you would want your locker rooms and your other support facilities, your training rooms, your concessions, everything else that goes along with that, with hosting those events.
Yeah, but most of the PE classes, so they would get moved as well, the PE classes? Or would they stay in the gymnasium?
Not necessarily. That's still being talked about in terms of the plan. There's nothing that says we wouldn't still leave gym and a gym and still have PE classes over here, but they would also have that option if they wanted to use the facilities over there for PE.
Yeah, so would the locker rooms at the existing gym be torn down, or just refurbished?
We've got a couple sets of locker rooms right now. We have a PE set of locker rooms that actually borders up against the cafeteria that could be left. The kids hardly use those now for PE anyway, but it's very easy to keep a PE locker room, yeah.
Yeah. So talk to us a little bit about how these improvements come into compliance, because we've heard that thrown around a lot. I mean, is it safety compliance? Is it Title IX compliance? Conference compliance? I mean, what are we talking about?
There's a little bit of an issue with a lot of the things you mentioned just because of the age. The best that I can come up with, the gyms that haven't been touched in the school, with the school being built in 1977, and I think there's been two remodels since then, they're a little bit dated. It's a little bit cramped in there. We do have some issues with equity that we'd like to solve just from a space standpoint and making sure all of our teams are taken care of in the same manner.
All right. So the claims that that we're providing sports just for boys and not girls is really incorrect.
Well, I would say you could go look at our track record. Our girls' sports are a little bit more dominant at the state level than our boys even. So our girls actually have more success than our boys' programs do.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about the indoor field house. If the field goes kind of where the Treasure Mountain footprint is, where does the field house get located from there?
Well, it would be on that piece of property, I think. Whether it's a north, south orientation or an east-west orientation, I still think is being talked about. We'll start attacking that with the design team as to exactly what that footprint looks like, but it would be somewhere next to that multi-purpose field for football, lacrosse, and soccer.
Yeah. Any idea? I mean, would you put the Dozier Field closer to the highway and the homes, or would that go back and then the field house, which is enclosed, go closer to the, you know, the homes there across from Kearns Boulevard?
Yeah, on that piece of property, it's tough to say. You know, both of those footprints really take up the middle. It's tough to move them north, the north end of the property, or south end of the property, or the east or the west. It's really just where they sit, whether the football field slash soccer slash lacrosse sits on the east side of the field house or on the west side of the field house if one goes in. But they pretty much take up the footprint about right where Treasure Mountain is. It almost be a field house, if you put it right where Treasure is, would almost look just the same.
So how big are we talking about in terms of field house? Any idea that what we should build?
Still under discussion as to what's best at this moment in time going forward, as well as try to put something in that we could possibly expand in the future if the need existed. But, you know, you're probably looking at about 60 yards.
Is that considered a full size?
No. To go full size, you're gonna have to go to 120 yards, which is rather large for an indoor field house.
All right. So is that about what we have with the Snyderville field house now?
No, I believe they're 70. I believe they're about 70.
Okay, but they consider that like a two-thirds field house because it's not a full football field, is that right?
Yeah, correct, yeah. And that's one of the details the design team will look at when we look at what else is going over there with it. If we're leaving a gym there as a basketball floor, if we're adding a weight room to that, if we're having tennis attached to that, I mean, that's all going to dictate what the actual open span of the indoor turf part of it looks like.
Yeah, and how would that benefit girls golf, an indoor field house? Would they be able to play golf in it?
Yeah, they'd be able to swing. We've actually talked about having a little bit of room in there for a couple simulators so that they can actually practice and play over the winter for both girls and boys. So yeah, it would benefit golf as well.
Yeah, and we're also talking about building tennis courts. How many and where would those go?
Well, you're looking at possibly a minimum of three, up to maybe six. They could. We're trying to get something that's covered if we did it, for obvious reasons with the season. The boys play primarily inside at the Mark, and we get squeezed over there quite a bit just because of the public demand. It's tough to get on there, so it would definitely help, as well as the inclement weather for the girls late in their season. But they would probably be on one end or side of that field house if we could work it out.
Okay. Anything else you think people should know about the facilities?
From my end, you know, we're just looking at taking care of our students and our student athletes and trying to do what's best for them or where we see our programs going, and trying to make sure the community has something to be proud of with our students.
Okay. Todd, I want to get back to you because this has been brought up several times. I mean, people's concern that we're building facilities for students that aren't even part of the Park City School District. Can you address that? I mean, how many out-of-district students do we currently have?
So we ran some numbers this morning to try to answer that question. And so what we're looking at is we have 151 out-of-boundary students. So that also includes students that are out of their elementary boundary that may be attending a different elementary. So they're a Park City resident, but they're attending a different boundary elementary school.
Maybe just because they're a parent, it's closer to work or something.
Actually, most of it is because of the dual language programs. You know, if you wanted to be in the French programs, there's only two schools that you can go to there, or Spanish, there's two schools. So there's most of that's that way.
All right. And when we look at where those, let's say, out-of-boundary students are coming from, I mean, how many are coming from Promontory?
So from Promontory specifically, so out of that number, in our records, we're showing that we have 15 that are coming from Promontory district-wide.
Okay, so elementary through?
K-12, yep.
Okay. And again, what do they have to pay? I mean, they live in very big, expensive homes. Their property taxes, though, go to South Summit School District.
Yeah, they do go to South Summit. And then under statute, we have the ability to cross-bill other districts. So we'll say, hey, your students are attending our schools. We're going to bill you for the property taxes that they've paid your district. And so we're able to claim about half of their property tax and 100% of the WPU.
So does that come close to the 10 grand that it costs Park City School District to educate one kid?
It comes about 3,000 short on that basis. But when you look at 15 students coming, that's not even a full class. So we haven't incurred $10,000 worth of cost because there'll be a couple in first grade, couple in second grade, couple in kindergarten. So it's just mixed in with the rest of a regular class size.
So if you were to look at Trailside, where we have kids now in portable classrooms, I mean, how many are out of boundary there?
So at Trailside specifically, we have 18 that are from out of boundary. And out of that, only two are from Promontory.
All right. So it's not that the out-of-boundary has caused the need for trailers there.
No, it's definitely a factor, but it's not the driving factor. We have our own growth happening. And part of it is due to the dual language programs offered there at the school.
Yeah. What about at Park City High School, where we're at 102% capacity?
Yeah. So at the high school out-of-boundary, we have a total of 36 students that are from out of boundary. And I don't know how many are from Promontory out of that count.
But that is significant because that's more than a class.
Yeah, a little bit more than a class. But again, you have so many sections. So it's a little bit different than elementary school where you have a teacher in front of a class all day long. At the high school, you have the students moving through their different sections throughout the day. And so again, 36 in a student body of 1,100 isn't a whole lot of students, not driving staffing.
Yeah. And in terms of future growth, I mean, you had a study done and consultants showed dropping, you know, 0.3%, increasing 1.1%, increasing 2.3%. I mean, what numbers are you using to move forward?
So we had used the numbers that I had garnered from earlier last year. We were looking at numbers that were in the 1.8% range as a forecast. Again, when I was running numbers for this morning, we took a quick look at enrollment, and the numbers I'll share today aren't official. Our official counts happen Thursday, October 1st, so we'll have some better numbers at that time. But right now, we're looking at tracking the same as last school year, so a little over 4,700 students. So we had anticipated a growth of about 100, and we're staying flat right now.
So when you're using numbers close to 2% and yet we're remaining flat, I mean, is that what you need to be doing, or do you really anticipate nearly 2% growth?
It's a little bit of a guessing game as to when will new construction come online, and no one knows that schedule for sure. So we were doing our forecasting, say, for the master planning process 5 and 6 years out, but exactly when will they come is unknown. But we just have a target. We say in 5 years it'll be probably 500 students, averaging 100 a year. They may all come next year. They may come in the third year. But we know that by that sixth year we'll have that kind of an account.
Okay, Jamie and Todd, I need to leave it there, but thank you for your time.
All right, thank you.
KPCW News Time now, 8:39. KPCW News Time now, 8:40. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour on KPCW. In the studio with me now, Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Leslie.
So, county council meeting, let's see, in Colville starting at 3:45, convening as the Board of Equalization. You have your final request in for...
I think this, we've got one more after this one. At least that's what they told me yesterday. So, just that'll be the final cleanup of the... adjustment process for the year.
Okay. Taking a big hit at all, or are you going to do okay?
I think we're doing fine. Nothing that the assessor or the auditor have mentioned.
Okay. Also scheduled to improve an employment contract for Mountain Regional Manager Andy Armstrong, and this is just something you've come on and said we need to do?
Absolutely. I mean, we've talked to the council about having professional contracts with each of the dependent district managers. Directors, and this is just another step in that process.
All right. Major item of business is in the work session, the presentation of the Solid Waste Capital Plan and Master Plan. So just bring us up to date. I mean, we're talking about closing out the existing cell and building a new one?
Well, that's just one of the things that's going on. I mean, we've got, you know, several years ago, the landfill was made an enterprise fund, which means that it's supposed to be running more like a business where we receive revenues that cover our expenses. We aren't there yet, so that's one of the discussion points. While we were looking at the CAFR this year with Matt Levitt, Councilman Robinson noticed that we were running a deficit in that fund, so we're still subsidizing the operation of our landfills and the capitalization of those landfills and our waste services with general fund money. Now, that's a decision that the council has made in the past that they want to do that, but it's something we need to look at on an annual basis to see if that's still how we want to fund that service.
Okay, and I know like what the city does here with the golf course, also an enterprise fund, fees go up if, you know what, if it's not paying its fair share.
You know, that's one of the possibilities. I mean, we're looking at some other things that could be revenue sources like green waste composting. Which could have some different revenues associated with it. So always looking at ways to bring that fund into the black and not as dependent on the general fund.
Well, it looks like in the report that Jaron Scott, the landfill supervisor, is proposing increasing the tipping fees.
Well, you know, he looks at it as his responsibility to respond to the council when they see that that deficit each year in order to re-educate the public, re-educate the council on what it would take to get it to self-supporting. That's one of the ways that we would go about that.
And then also recommending a charge of $24 now a household, which is up from where?
You know, because the deficit is quite significant, there is not a fee per household at this time. And tipping fees are slightly lower than the average around the state. So that's just one of the areas that we could go to. Not sure where council's going to go on this. In the past, they have not wanted to raise fees. They wanted to keep it at the same way. Perfectly happy to do that. It's just, as we know, with total budget, if you're subsidizing it to a certain extent, that's money that can't go to other things.
It's $2 a month, right, to have somebody come pick up your garbage once a week?
That's correct.
Okay. How big of a deficit are we talking about?
It depends on how you look at it. If you look at it over I'm not going to give you a specific number because I don't remember from the CAFR, but I believe annually we're subsidizing our service and our landfill operation somewhere in the tune of about $3 million. So fairly significant.
All right. So what input are you looking for from the county council in terms of
It's this whole discussion is really a reaction to what Councilman Robinson brought up when we were looking at that CAFR. He would like to take a look at that again to see if this is still where we want to go. But really it's a discussion about the overall budget and how we look at that and other things that the council wants to do in the future. For instance, increase funding for transportation projects.
So some talk about the county thinking about going for a bond next year to transportation?
That's one of the areas that we have to look at. We have a couple of bonds that are maturing this year and next year. that we could reissue in order to put some revenue or put some spending into transportation projects for the long term. One of the things we look at was that. Also, we need to be looking again at that local option that the state has given us to consider as a county in order to raise some revenue for transportation.
All right. In terms of the new landfill, where are we with regard to the Bevel waste discussion?
You know, we're continuing to work really close with Park City Municipal and the EPA to decide where that stuff's going to go long term. You know, I've heard Diane talk on the radio a couple of times about how a recent action memo was completed between the EPA and United Park City Mines to deal with some of the waste issues up on the mountain. That's an ongoing process, you know, going from the top of the watershed down in order to deal with those contaminated soil issues that exist in Park City and in the lower Silver Creek area. Continuing those conversations, and there's a lot of moving parts around it, but, you know, I think that the main thing that I'm getting out of these discussions is that we're a lot closer to each other's opinions and determinations on where these things should go and how we should get there than we are apart.
So this is the time of year that we start the budget preparation. It'll be your first as county manager. Things looking okay?
Things are looking pretty good, actually. We've got a little bit more revenue to deal with this year. My budget committee has been working hard to respond to our departments and offices on what they're asking for in their budgets. I'm looking over all of those recommendations right now and meeting with each of my department heads and the elected officials that are choosing to meet with me about that. And we will go over that, and I have to present to council by October 15th my recommended budget.
All right. So say that the council does say, well, we should go to a charge, you know, an increased household charge for waste collection. Is that then require a tax hearing?
I don't know the answer to that one yet. So I kind of want to hear what the council has to say first before I go down that road. But I'm quite certain that the county attorney's office will tell me how to line that up if whatever way the council chooses to go.
Yeah, certainly you'll have a public hearing, but whether or not it needs to be a truth in taxation hearing remains
absolutely
to be seen.
Yep. And you know, the truth in taxation stuff that happens in Utah, I'm still getting up to speed on that, so I rely on the attorney's office quite a bit.
All right, Tom, anything else you wanted to mention?
You know, we've talked a lot in the last few weeks about some planning issues, and there's certainly been some big ones. Pat Putt, our planning director, kind of softly launched a new program last Friday at Hugo Coffee, Coffee with a Planner. You know, I'm stealing the Sheriff Martinez's moniker on that. But just to get our planners and our planning director out into the community a little bit to talk about and be available to our citizens on some of these big planning issues.
I'll be talking to him about that during the local news hour on Friday.
And excellent.
We're kind of calling it, what's that, Pat?
Excellent.
Okay. Hey, Tom, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Well, the Park Silly Sunday Market just concluded its ninth season on Main Street. In the studio with a recap, I have the market's executive director, Kate Board, and director of operations, Michelle McDonald. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Okay, so what, 14 weeks of silliness?
Correct. We had 14 Sundays. We had a little break in between, but yeah, 14 overall.
Which you had to love, huh?
I did, yeah. that break worked out real well.
Yeah, so how did it go? Your attendance up?
Our attendance was up. We had 188,000 people this year. And last
that we
year
counted.
That we counted, correct. last year we had 162, so almost a 14% increase.
And that's just watching people come from the main entrances? Is that how
exactly.
Is that how you count people?
Yep. We have clickers at Heber and Main, another clicker at 9th Avenue and Park, a bike valet, and then the farmers market.
Yeah, so why is that important though, to keep track of how many people?
Just so we can kind of monitor the growth, as well as it's good for sponsorship numbers. And also, too, we have city initiatives that we have to meet and goals that we have to meet with the city, and those types of numbers are what we have to report.
Yeah. So, I mean, what about your vendors? I mean, when you see, you know, what, 26,000 more people, I mean, are they making, you know, that much more money, too?
We assume they're doing well, particularly when there's about 30% of them that want to return each year. So we don't actually know their daily income. We know the tax numbers they generate for the city. But other than that, their willingness and enthusiasm for coming back is what tells us they're doing well.
Good. So you're already asking for people to apply for next summer?
We probably have 30-some-odd applications in already for 2016.
Correct. We also have the Holiday Bazaar that happens in December, and that sold out within about 2.5 weeks' time. Almost 90 vendors.
Oh, my. Okay.
Yeah.
And that's at the Park City Marriott, December 11, 12, and 13.
Okay. So in terms of the total number of vendors, I mean, you say a third of them, but not every vendor shows up every week, right?
Exactly.
Correct. Unique every week is ultimately the motto and the goal that we've established back 9 years ago. And so we do have a nice flow of vendors. We're also limited in certain vendor categories, so we have to make sure that we're flipping those numbers and not just capitalizing on one person who wants all 14 Sundays. Michelle does a really great job of mixing it up so that it is unique, so that the locals, when they come, they see something new.
So on any given Sunday, you have how many out there?
We have about 170 vendors each Sunday. And it was even good for us to remember how unique we are, because we do sell out in advance. The last two Sundays, I mean, during load-in, where I'm meeting people realizing it's their first Sunday of the summer, coming on September 14th.
Just because they couldn't get in before.
Well, either they couldn't get in, or, you know, different artist products are more appropriate in the fall than in the summer, that sort of thing.
Okay. So working on ideas for next year?
We are working on ideas for next year. Next year is going to be our 10-year anniversary. So
Yay.
We're going to bring back Kimberly Kuhn and Jules Harrison and Julie. Those are the three gals that ultimately started the market. And we have to do something special for them. So I'd love to tell you I know exactly what that is. But we don't just yet. But we're working on some really great ideas. Big bands, so it'll be a really nice big kickoff.
Yeah. So you had just a year's contract with Park City. Do you start that process over, or have you already been approved for another year next summer?
We actually, there was a year interim, and then now we're actually working on a three-year contract. So we're in a three-year contract. So 2014, 2015, 2016 are solidified. We are currently working for 2017 and beyond. So yes, that's already been in the works. We've already met with the city. We're having our official debrief with City Council in the first week of October. And, yes, we are very much not going anywhere as far as we're concerned.
Yeah. In terms of the numbers, I mean, I think for you and for your sponsorship, you say you need to have every Sunday. I think that's probably the biggest criticism. I mean, maybe it was vendor choice and the food, but I think it's kind of now narrowed on that some Old Town residents just are tired of every Sunday. I mean, have you thought about reducing the numbers of Sundays, or you just can't?
It's, as of right now, just the way that the contract's written, we are guaranteed our 14. We're always open to, you know, the conversations. The city also steps in, the Historic Main Street Alliance. We meet with them as well on a semi-weekly and then as well monthly basis. Their last statement was they feel like our footprint is fine, the amount of Sundays is fine, and the number of hours that we're on the street is fine. So far that doesn't seem to be. There's also the new city brought in a group of people just to talk about special events, and so that's kind of a few of those came up. And then, you know, as soon as somebody says one thing, somebody else within that counteracts it. And we just kind of wait and listen and see. I mean, we're not opposed to anything. We want to make sure that everybody's happy. But, of course, that never happens.
Yeah. So certainly you've been working, I know, diligently with the merchants. What about, I mean, are residents part of that, though, that discussion?
They are in that committee now with council, right?
Correct.
What is that? The
Special Events Committee. Yeah.
They have an acronym Special Events Committee. Yeah. So within that, we've talked to Jason Glidden, Jenny Dearson, who are our liaisons for the city. We've asked them certain questions, you know, their surveys, and that those meetings have just started happening. And so it's more or less, you know, just waiting to really find out after they really delve into all the events. So we're definitely one of the larger ones, but in actuality, it's just we're just waiting to see what the outcome is.
Okay, and real quick, I know that you used to pride yourself on the zero waste. How did things work out that way? You still making that happen?
Our zero waste was very successful. Again, this year we actually had an 84% diversion rate.
Which came out to 14,380 pounds of trash were recycled. And that's all of our glass. We specifically take it to the recycle center, and then all the commingled goes into a commingled dumpster. And we only sent just over 2,000 pounds to the landfill. So that's not bad for 188,000 people. And on top of that, we gave away a ton of free booths between nonprofits, Main Street merchants, Park City performing artists. We gave over 200 free booths to farmers, kids' activities, sustainable issues. So we do, you know, we're trying to do our part. That's one of our missions as well.
Okay, we'll see you back in December for the bazaar.
Thank you so much, Leslie.
It's Kate Boyd and Michelle McDonald. KPCW News Time now, 8:56. Well, coming up this Friday, October 2nd, it's the sneaker soiree to benefit Girls on the Run. In the studio with details, I have Lydia Kluge. She's a board member with the foundation, and Heidi Hewitt, one of the coaches for Girls on the Run. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
So this is an event taking place in Salt Lake, 6 to 9 p.m. upstairs at the Gallivan Center. Is that because Girls on the Run is what, a national or a statewide organization?
Yes, we're a national organization. We are present in North America and Canada, and we started here in Utah in 2007, initially down in Salt Lake City, and a few years ago we spread up into Park City, and last year down into Wasatch County too. So in Summit and Wasatch, we reach about 200 girls and are present at the elementary schools and at Echo Hill Middle School here.
Okay, and the purpose of the group is what?
We're a positive youth development program. We meet after schools from February through till March, and we work towards a 5K run, and we weave the training for that run with curriculum that helps the girls, inspire them to be joyful, to be healthy, and to be confident. Our lessons cover things like healthy eating and body image and how to deal with bullying, to give them kind of a rubric of things that they can say and ways they can stand up for themselves. And we try and cover stuff in our curriculum that isn't necessarily covered in what they learn at school, or maybe they're not getting from their parents, just things that are really vital for those girls in that age range to help them out in life.
All right, so do you have tickets left then to the soiree?
Yes, yeah, we have tickets left. We sold out of our sponsorship tables and it's looking really good, but we still have tickets for individuals, and you can go online to our website on girlsontherunutah.org and find out more about tickets there. And then if you're not able to come to the event, we also have great opportunity drawing that Heidi can tell us a little more about, and you can get tickets for that too.
Tickets are $45 in advance and $55 at the door, and then we are selling our opportunity drawing tickets, rather, for things like a $2,000 Maverick gift card. Who can't use that? The tickets for the opportunity drawing are $20 each, or 3 for $50, and you can contact me or Lydia to get those.
Okay. What's the best way to get a hold of you?
You can reach me just by phone, 435-901-4068. Text or call me, and I'm happy to get you some tickets.
Okay. So you'd like a good showing, I'm guessing, from the Summit Wasatch County areas?
Yes, we'd love to have lots of people there to come and support us. Actually, about a third of our girls in the program are on scholarships. So the money that we raise at the fundraiser will help to include them in the program. We won't turn any girls away. We like to include people. And the scholarships also help fund the girls that can't afford running shoes and things like that to cover the running shoes and the cost of the program, so that everyone can be involved and we can provide the program to all the people that are interested in joining.
Okay, that website again then?
girlsontherunutah.org.
Okay, Lydia and Heidi, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Morning News and the Local News Hour with Leslie Thatcher is provided by Park City Medical Center, Jan's Mountain Outfitters, Deer Valley Resort, and Promontory and the Promontory Foundation.